Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, Eddie.
Hey, what's up?
How are you, man?
I'm good.
Man, I've been missing your fades.
My fades.
I've been doing the fades myself.
Oh, you were over on this side last
yeah.
week?
Yeah. Man in the controls. And I was like, Eddie, how does he do it?
It's not really that hard. There's like two buttons.
It's perfect,
it's
though.
It's pretty
it's
easy.
It's like you are the symphony
it's pretty,
maestro
it's
of
It's pretty
fades.
Unimpressive what I do.
We're just going to jump right in.
We jump right in.
Guest.
Go for it.
Really, really awesome drummer and great friend, Shay Godwin. Loves you already,
man. All right.
How you been, man?
I've been great.
Dude, I've been trying to get you on this show for months.
Yeah, the stars finally aligned.
The stars finally aligned, and I'm so excited because you're doing so many cool things. You're playing with Andra Day, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep, keeping busy with that mostly.
Yeah, and are you doing like any like world touring, or is it just in the U.S. mostly?
There's not a lot of touring going on right now. Most of the traveling has been in relation to a song that we've been performing with Common recently that was in the Thurgood Marshall movie.
Yep.
Called Stand Up for Something.
Did you just do the big
Washington? I didn't do the rally.
Okay.
No,
they
but
did that then, right?
They did.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, we've been traveling a lot doing that song, mostly in town writing though. It's a challenge schedule wise, but we've been writing as much as possible as a band.
That's amazing.
For her next album, and they, you know, they're being pretty patient at the moment, so we're continuing to plug away and write.
I saw her play with Stevie Wonder, and that was the first time I think I actually heard her live. Andra Day is like one of the new, she's like a pretty new soul singer. It's in the last like 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, she was nominated for 2 Grammys in 2015, and that's when she kind of came on the scene. You know how it is. People are working for a lot longer than before
overnight
they
success.
Come into the public eye. You know, she's, you know, but 2015 is when she mostly came into public awareness.
Well, let's go way back. Eddie, you ready for this?
Yeah, now I am. You need to give me a second.
You need a dramatic
I finished pause. Swallowing that water.
We're going to go way back to Little Shay first getting his drum set. What was the catalyst?
How do you spell Shay, by the way?
S-H-A-Y.
S-H-A-Y. Okay, that makes sense.
It's not even my real name. It's a nickname.
Oh.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
see?
Yeah, hey, my name is Angus Shavers Godwin,
okay.
Jr. And Shay's a nickname from my middle name, which is my grandmother's maiden name. Shay's a nickname. And
Angers is your first name?
Was it?
Angus. Angers would be out. That'd be a badass name.
Angers.
People think Angus is a much cooler name, but yeah, Shay's a childhood nickname that never went away. So.
Huh? I've known this guy for about maybe 16, 17 years, and I never knew that.
Well, see, now you do. All right, what are we talking about?
We're learning already.
No, so what was the moment where you knew you wanted to play drums? Was it a song? Was it somebody kind of influencing you? What was the zen moment for you?
You know, I wasn't all that focused so as a kid, so when that should have happened, it didn't. But there actually came a time when some friends of mine had a band and they needed someone to play drums, and I was into music, and I had an interest in drumming that I just hadn't crystallized in my mind because I was kind of a flailing little kid. Couldn't really focus on things that easily. So
Eddie's like that as an adult.
I'm a guy right now.
No, I still have my struggles.
I couldn't even tell you what you just said.
He's still working on the spelling of your name right now.
Work it out. So, some friends of mine needed a drummer, so I just started. One of the guys was the son of the local high school band director, so I was able to use the school drums for like almost a year before I finally got a kit of my own.
So you didn't do any marching band, any jazz band, nothing?
I eventually got into concert band and jazz band. Honestly, that was a lot of time. That was the only reason I attended school on some days. And marching band, there wasn't really a marching band per se at my little school that I went to. We had a concert band that did like a march a year, and
just
the
one
march I did made me quit.
The annual march.
and the one I did, this is so pathetic. I left.
You're like, I'm marching out of here.
You want me to wear what? I'm not wearing that.
You know, I said to myself going in here, I wasn't going to see anything embarrassing, and I've already failed.
So, no, yeah, it's all right. It's a part of this.
I left the march.
I walked away.
I veered off and left.
Wait, during the march
yes.
you left?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's ballsy,
and
dude.
I'm just glad this is long before the days of social media and, you know. But anyway,
you could have been a star.
Were people yelling for you to come back as you were walking away?
I don't think anybody cared.
No one cared?
I wasn't doing that well. No.
Wait, so you just stormed? Were you angry?
You took the drums and everything?
You know, I was like, it's hot. I'm wearing wool. What am I doing right now? Is there really any problem with me leaving? And I just...
That's amazing. Yeah. Dude, that is that's one of the coolest stories, because in marching band, like I was in marching band in school, and it was like, that was like a cardinal sin. Like, you're kind of a hero to me right now.
You know what? It's pathetic, because there's a real culture to marching bands and drum corps. And
yeah. You literally marched to the beat of your own drum.
In retrospect,
like, literally did it.
Been a part of that.
You literally did it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Good for you.
That's awesome.
Hey, not good for me, but I can't believe I said that out loud.
Well, mm-hmm. What part of the drums did you play in the marching band? Did you have the big...
I had a snare drum. Okay. Luckily, there was one other guy playing.
Did you say anything to him?
No.
You just left. You just renegaded. Kinda.
What'd you do with the drum?
I walked back to the school. It was open. Put it down. Changed. And I left.
That's awesome. Dude.
It's something.
That was the start or the end of everything.
But in all seriousness, Joe Prevost, who was the band director at my little school in Trumansburg, he was a great guy, and I wish I hadn't done that. And I got a lot out of being in his jazz band. So,
and what city or state was this in?
This was Trumansburg, New York, which I tell people I'm from Ithaca when people ask, because Cornell is there, so right. People have heard of it. No one's ever heard of Trumansburg, New York. Although the first Moog synthesizer was made there. People think of it as Rochester because that's where, you know, the first one came off a conveyor belt. But it was actually developed in little podunk Trumansburg.
How far is Trumansburg from Albany?
From Albany?
Yeah.
3 hours.
Okay, so you're all in the sticks in that area.
It's
right?
Well, Ithaca's a small city surrounded by... really small towns and a lot of woods. Yeah.
Right. So you just marched in the woods.
I used to just run around with packs of wolves.
You were raised by wolves.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And then how did you get into rock and roll, jazz? Like, who was the person that kind of showed you? Did your dad play or did he show you music?
Well, yeah. My dad was a professor of voice at Ithaca College.
Oh, wow.
Where I ended up going there. It was a free education. But... Yeah, you know, in high school I was in a band. We were called Wire Crickets, and one of the guys in the band, his name was Matt Cox, and he was, at the time, he was kind of a tastemaker for me. You know, he turned me on to a lot of music, you know, from punk rock to progressive rock to, he got me into Public Enemy, you know. That was a big thing for me in terms of... developing political viewpoints, and I just love the music, and it would, you know, all the sampling would make me want to dig in and find out where they came from, which was not the easiest thing. It's easy now.
Well, it's Clyde Stubblefield mostly. There was so much of that in
a bunch of that.
All the James Brown.
Yeah, sure, but this, you know, some of those songs have, you know, up to 50 samples per song. Some of those old Public Enemy, before you had to clear stuff. So,
the Wire Crickets. You gotta ask the question, Eddie.
What?
The name
I
of the
honestly
band.
Don't remember where that came from.
The Wire Crickets?
Well, not my idea.
You don't know where that could...
I think it might have been a poem.
So you guys were like super abstract. way in the beginning?
No, actually, we were just trying to emulate first punk and new wave bands that we were into, and then eventually started trying to emulate prog rock bands that we were into. We actually had a following when we were doing our punk new wave
awesome.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then when we kind of went into our prog rock thing, all of a sudden the crowds disappeared. I mean, completely disappeared.
Did you ever play in the city?
No.
Was that like
no.
way too far?
I was a kid. I mean, okay. I wasn't even... we just played locally. We went to Syracuse. We went to Rochester. But we played mostly locally. And it was just, you know... It's always about talking people into letting me play in the club, you know, because I was a kid.
And this is... Everybody in your band has been like...
We were all kids.
You're all renegades. Well, you were the drummer that left the march. You had a reputation. Of course you were a punk rock band. You had to have that. And then how did you get into other styles of music? Because you play everything. I mean, I've heard you play jazz. I've heard you play soul, rock, blues, everything.
Actually, in my senior year, I went to Michigan. I went to a school at a place called Interlochen Arts Academy, and I got into jazz there. And that's when I first started being disciplined about my approach to being a musician in the first place, is there. I don't even know how to get into it. One thing went to another. It's always you listen to one thing, and that makes you listen to another, that makes you listen to another. I mean... People were trying to get me to listen to jazz, and I wasn't ready for it. But when people were first trying to get me to listen to it, but I was listening to Bill Bruford and all kinds of prog stuff. You know, Bill Bruford had a band with Alan Holdsworth, and then from there I listened to Tony Williams' Lifetime because I loved Alan Holdsworth, and then dug into the second Classic Miles
Quartet. That's pretty heavy stuff.
And started just veering off into all kinds of different directions.
That's like, how old are you? In your 20s?
Well, at that point I was 17.
That's 18. Pretty heavy music to listen to as a high school kid.
Well, I guess. I mean, there's kids, you know, very sophisticated musical sensibilities by the time they're 12, some of them. It's rare, but, you know, you see some pretty impressive musical youth.
Is that what you kind of wanted to do initially? You were thinking, that's where I wanted to go?
No, I mean, well, by the time I was 17 and 18, I was thinking in terms of career. Before that, I don't think I was thinking that far ahead. I was just enjoying playing immensely.
What were you listening to at 17, Eddie?
17, was that high school?
Yeah, maybe junior year. For me, it was Nirvana and Hendrix, I remember.
Yeah, Nirvana came later for me. Teen Spirit had just
broken.
Hit and when I was 17. So like that, and I discovered Pearl Jam around that time.
That was right.
And I was kind of getting out of like a metal phase, you know, like Maiden and stuff like that, going into more of the grunge stuff.
Yeah, like whenever I hear, like it's kind of interesting to see what people listen to in high school, because those years for me shaped what I listen to now. I mean, it's like what I was listening to Hendrix way back then, and I'm still listening to Hendrix, and just it's a different,
sure.
You know, it's like a different rite of passage. Now I hear more in what I was listening to back then, but there were ingredients of things.
Yeah, like the late 80s, early 90s were like, it was not a good time for like that, like contemporary type music. It was like Vanilla Ice
and
stuff like that.
Dixie Hammer.
The industry was confused.
It was really like...
The industry's still confused.
Well, it's confusing.
It was just... It was a weird time music. I mean, I was into like hard rock and heavy metal, but like as far as like top 40 stuff, it was like really... There wasn't like a lot of substance there.
By the way, I watched the Vanilla Ice movie recently.
Cool as Ice?
Yes.
That's... Dude, I'm going to get those pants for Eddie for Christmas.
I watched the Riff Trax version.
What's that version?
I mean, I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but everybody should watch Riff Trax.
Riff Trax is amazing.
That's the guys that did Mystery Science 3000 originally.
Okay.
You got to watch them do the Room.
That's amazing. Just
watch them do the Room. It's hilarious.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Is that even necessary?
No, it's not. But it makes you have to do less work in your head.
Maybe they said.
Oh, hi, Mark.
It's so the Riff Trax. They're amazing.
That's amazing. When did you come to Los Angeles? When did you make that track?
That was 1999.
Yep. What was the reason? You were just like, I
was on a cruise ship, and I thought I had grown as much as I could from playing on cruise ship situations. I was kind of hanging around a little longer than I meant to because of a relationship I was in. and but the ship I was on was porting in Los Angeles, and my boy Derek Frank was living here and was just like, move off the ship, just come to LA. And I said, all right, I'll just
That's amazing. That's tough, though.
I used to have fantasies about moving to New York, and for a lot of different reasons, I moved away from that idea.
I still have that fantasy, Shay. I'd still play with it in my mind.
Alternate universe fantasy.
Yeah. It's
at least
like
for me.
I had to be a different person to live there. But
I think it'd be cool to live downtown.
Yeah, I mean,
but that's not gonna happen.
But it's not like a downtown like New York. Like, there's so much energy. But a lot of musicians I know that are in New York, they're like, oh, it's a grind, man. It's not an easy world to be a musician, period. But to be a musician in New York, it's even harder.
It's not good to be an artist in New York anymore,
yeah.
I don't think.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
They're pushing a lot of that out of the cities. Same in San Francisco's like that, too. Let's play something that you recorded or...
Yeah. I sent you a few tunes. Let's just go chronologically. There's a song called Haunted, I sent you.
All right, here we go.
Who's the artist?
Charlotte Martin. And this was from a 2004 release at the time on RCA, when she was with RCA.
She was, you were touring with her for a while, for like 3 or 4 years, right? Charlotte?
We didn't tour that much. We did. I mean, we traveled a little bit, but we didn't go on any full tours as a band. Economically, she chose to do solo tours for the most part. She can definitely do that because she's
touring?
A one-woman show.
She's still touring?
She actually stopped touring recently. I'm not really in touch with her. She's a great person, though. I saw an announcement that she made that she's not touring anymore. I don't know if it's a family life thing, but... well, you know, I hope it's not a bummer. I hope there's a good reason for it. But yeah, she's a powerhouse. You know, she's very skilled on the piano and just strong. Really
did you have to
strong.
Do like an audition, or was it with like?
Oh yeah,
referral?
I auditioned for her. Yep.
What are those? You know, I've never done like an audition like as a side guy. It's like I've always gotten work like as a referral. But I hear horror stories of just 20 people playing the same kind of groove, and it's just like it's like kind of a weird vibe.
Yeah. Well. I haven't had to do that for a long, long time. Partially because I'm too old and I don't get called for a lot of those things. A lot of those things were for like younger pop stars, and I just don't quite have the look anymore. And I'm not willing to work for as little as a lot of the, you know, the young pop stars.
And it's like a bullshit kind of experience.
Well,
like a lot of people, they just tell me, like, oh man, it's like not even about your playing. It's about so many other things. And it's just like a very political.
You know, you got to just decide what you want. But certainly with a lot of the pop gigs, it's going to be not the greatest paying. Certainly if you're living in Los Angeles, it's probably not going to pay that great. If you live in, you know, I know a bass player who's a great bass player. He lives in South Carolina. He played with... am I saying this right? Jenny Monte, is that how you say her name?
I don't know.
Anyway, I think that's how you say her name. You know.
You mean Janelle Monáe?
That's it.
Okay, I was like.
Oh my gosh.
See,
I embarrassed myself for the second time. Janelle Monáe.
That's all right.
Yeah, anyway. Janelle Monáe.
There could be a Janelle Monáe in France.
Anyway, you know, he played with her, and I don't know what the pay was like. It was probably kind of typical L.A. pop pay, which is not great for L.A. Probably great for South Carolina, you know.
Right.
But anyway, you know, it's like heavy tracks, no room for to breathe or interpret or do different things from night to night. It's a full-on production show with a lot of these things, and... that can be really cool. If you want to do that, that's fine. But I'm certainly grateful to not have to do that right now.
Well, I don't know a lot of people that actually love those gigs, even when they're in them, because I think there's so much about what you just said. It's really cool. It is about the interpretation of music and taking something and kind of creating some vibe or experience that's not the same night after night where... You know, I think a lot of those gigs, you just start phoning it in. That's what a lot of people, you know, I know some musicians that played Super Bowls and stuff, and they're like, yeah, it was not as happening as I thought it would be. Like, it looks cool, but it's not, like, as organic as, it's all, that's like the show business part of it, you know?
Yeah, you know, sometimes you can get a lot more of a buzz and a lot more energy, you know, at the hotel cafe.
Right.
With a bunch of people sitting right there and listening. You know,
right.
Intently.
Rather than the big faceless mob.
Yeah.
Speaking of really cool experiences, Eddie, I was telling you off the air, Shay and I did a gig. I was just getting out of music school, so I was like, man, this is kind of a crazy experience. But we got called to do a gig for Carlos Santana. He was getting a humanitarian award, and it was a concert with 18 jazz musicians and singers and dancers. And we played a bunch of Santana tunes with Nestor Torres, Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter. Tell us a little bit about that experience, because, you know, I always tell people about it, but I don't know a lot of people that were still, you know, in that experience, like, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, it kind of blew my mind when you brought it up in the email. I don't actually bring it up with people. I mean, I tell people about it just conversationally, but I'm probably too far from the mic. I tell people about it conversationally occasionally, but I don't bring it up a lot. Certainly never put it on the resume. Like,
right,
you know,
right.
I sent my bio over and I had a list of some people I played with. I didn't put Wayne and Herbie on it. You know, it's like a respect thing. I played with them that one time. They didn't hire me. They're like, there's certain cats that we put on pedestals,
right,
you know,
right.
And they're that's those guys.
They are the ultimate.
And, you know, Florence.
I was in a show with Dave Chappelle, but I don't go saying I opened for Dave Chappelle. Like we shared the same stage on one night, but it's not like I'm not his opener. It's a different.
Why not, Eddie?
Because it's lying and it's not true.
Time you did a show with him and you're in the same room with him, so that's a really good thing.
Yeah, but it's like sort of the same thing. Like you don't like.
But yeah, here's the thing. You know, I sent you my list of some people I played with. I mentioned Florence Welch from Florence and the Machine. I only played with her once, and she didn't hire me specifically. And I respect her, but I don't put her on the same pedestal as Herbie and Wayne. So I went ahead and mentioned her, but like. I don't put Herbie and Wayne on.
And
but that was an amazing experience.
It was a delicate experience because it was like so beautiful. It was like such an amazing moment.
It was a humanitarian award for Carlos Santana because he's, he's been really active on a humanitarian level for a number of years. That was an amazing experience. And I remember Miguel Atwood Ferguson did the arrangements. And
that's right.
Yep.
And it was killing. It was like. I'm still chasing that sound, I think, just musically, because it was so big. The sound, I just remember moments thinking, I've never heard a band sound this gigantic. And with Santana tunes, there's so much open, room, so people were throwing down solos, trading solos. I mean, it was pretty extraordinary. You were just talking off the air about how Wayne Shorter was just standing right next to your cymbal.
Standing next to my crash cymbal and looked at me and smiled a couple times, and I thought I was going to fall off my chair. It took a lot for me to focus. Really, there are guys that you put on that pedestal, and man, Wayne.
He's up there. Let's play something else. I want to play something else that you brought in. What did you bring in?
Let's play Love and Light by the Dirty Diamond.
There nice. It is.
I've awakened to my life again, conquered myself and rehearsed my very death. And times over, I've purchased slaughters and genocide. I charge the terrain that most choose to avoid. So into the void I go, but at the end of it all, behind the wall. Mount of love and light. At the end of it all, down the hall, the quantum field of love and light. Your love and light is all that I saw. I was tortured and paralyzed. Persecuted and crucified, I died. To my impaled hands I cried. I was enslaved, but I reconciled. I dive into pain the most choose to avoid. So into the void I go. End of the ride, when I had arrived, mass amount of love and light. At the end of the ride, when I had arrived, quantum field of love and light. Your love and light is all that myself again.
conquered my life and rehearsed my very death a thousand times over. At the end of my lease, when I was released, a vast amount of love and light. At the end of the lease, when I was released, all I found was love and light. The love and light is all that I, all that I saw.
About this, it's like a very eclectic group of musicians, all LA based, right? Yep. Derek Frank is on bass, who's been a guest here, and Sam. Tell me a little bit how that band came about and what's going on with you guys.
How do I do this without going on and on? I used to play with a Persian artist named Siavash Gomeshi, and as I was touring around,
you got that name right, not the other one.
I don't know how you did that. And there were other associated artists that we'd be doing bills with, and so we I'd see some of the same musicians travel around, and one of them was a guy named Orbel Babayan, just a ripping guitar player. And we had a lot of fun hanging out overseas, and then his brother Sam Babayan was in a band called Slow Motion Rain that was kind of winding down. And they were signed, and I'm forgetting what label they were on. Things were kind of falling apart with that band, but I did like one of their very last shows as a sub. Then...
Was Derek in the band?
Derek was not in the band. Derek's been in the band for the past 3 years. There's been a lot of different personnel changes in the Dirty Diamond. But fast forward a couple years, and I'm doing library sessions for a producer, just doing library music sessions. And then I was doing mostly this brush jazz stuff. And he calls me up one day. He's like, "Hey, do you play rock?" And I was like, "Yeah, I play rock." He's like, "Hey, I've got this band. Their drummer is in the pit orchestra for the Wicked show." And
Was it Joel Alpers who called you?
No, it was before Joel Alpers. Okay. I'm forgetting the guy's name that was in the Dirty Diamond before me for a very brief time. He needed a sub in the recording studio, so I went in and learned a few songs and rocked him out in the studio. And there was Sam. I was like, "I know this guy. I'd done this gig with Slow Motion Rain, and I toured with your brother." It's like, small world kind of thing. Anyway, I really enjoyed the tunes, and it was very soon that I was doing live shows and quickly a member of the band.
And I think you recruited Derek, didn't you?
I recruited Derek. Yes,
Derek,
I did.
We should get Derek. Derek is a badass. He also plays with Shania Twain.
Shania Twain, Air Supply.
That's right.
Lots of people.
Which is pretty
Daniel
cool.
Daniel Powter right now, or going on a tour coming up soon.
Yeah, and it's all like LA session musicians and songwriters, and the arrangements are really lush. I like that you are able to switch gears from somebody like a Charlotte Martin, or you were playing with Butterfly
Boucher.
Boucher
a long time ago,
yeah, I remember that. So it's like here in Dirty Diamond, it's like very rock driven, kind of anthemic tunes. And I just love your playing on it. It's really, it's awesome. Very pocket.
Thank you very much.
Balls to the wall, rock and roll, man.
Thanks, man.
But with good songs, like that's hard to do. I think that's something that's kind of like a dying breed right now, But yeah, man, it's amazing.
Appreciate
and then,
that.
How long have you been playing with Andre? You said you've been touring with her for the last three years?
I did my first gig with her late 2014 as a sub. The guy that was playing with her got caught up with some other things. A guy named Mike Bennett, great drummer. He got caught up, I think, with Richie Kotzen or something else.
Oh,
he does a lot of things. And he was so busy that I just kind of ended up being the guy. And we toured with Lenny Kravitz. That was our first. I think that was the first tour I went on with her, if I'm recalling correctly. And we've done some headlining tours, and it's been great. It's all been excellent. I love the guys that I'm playing with.
Yeah, you were saying there was like a family vibe in the in the groove.
Definitely.
Just in the members, and it's all been the same members pretty much the whole time in her band.
As long as I've been in there, yeah. When I was first playing with her, there was a bassist named Teron Creighton. He's with Demi Lovato now.
Okay.
This guy named Nando Arroyo, who's just a tremendous bass player and musician and writer. He's got a solo album that is it's mind blowing. Has Catrice Buckingham all over it,
he's
and
a great
Jimmy
player.
Blanley, and forgetting who else, but really intense album. And Dave Wood plays guitar. Charles Jones is the keyboard player.
Oh, he's badass. Is he in the band?
He is. Oh yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah.
He was with Rafael Sadiq for a while.
Yeah.
Right?
He still plays with him. He does studio stuff with him. Yeah. He's got a long association with Rafael.
I didn't know
Sadiq.
That he was playing with Andre. That's amazing. Yeah. He's great. He's a great singer too.
Oh. Yeah.
He's
that
like
guy is an
scary.
Otherworldly talent. We could just talk about him the
I know.
Whole thing. But
I
like,
know.
Let me just try and sum up what's special about Charles. The different areas that he can honestly and legitimately dip into musically.
Right.
Like, you know, he grew up in the church, and he played organ in the church and knows that whole thing intimately, and that's part of his blood. But he was an opera major at USC, right? And can just improvise classical music in a way that most classical musicians cannot do.
Yeah.
They used to be able to do.
Yeah. We were in the same program, but he was 2 years, I think he was 2 years younger than me.
Okay.
So I knew of him, but he, like, you know, when you're 2 years older, you're just like ready to get out, dude, at that point. But
he's a phenom.
He's a phenom.
It's there's just the combination of skills that he has is otherworldly and unique. So
yeah, he's a great cat. Tell us a little bit about this Andre Day Strange Fruit cover. And I know it's a really hard cover, but I think is she the first person that's ever done that song?
No, there's a long history to that song. It was it was a poem that was written, I believe, in 1938. Forgive me if I'm getting my dates wrong here, but I think it was written in 1938. I'm forgetting the guy's name. Billie Holiday sang it in 1939, put it to music. Mm. The lyrics, well, we'll listen to it, so it's just important to listen to the lyrics, and I recommend anybody look up the lyrics.
It's powerful.
Look up the poem, because it juxtaposes
song,
two different versions of the South.
Mm.
It's strong. I mean, the lyrics themselves are strong. The story behind, can I tell you the story behind
the
recording?
Yeah, please, because Eddie doesn't know the song, too, so...
There's a guy named Brian Stevenson, who's head of an organization that's been around for decades called the Equal Justice Initiative. He's a Harvard lawyer, and they've done a lot for racial justice and to exonerate many wrongfully convicted people. And I read his book called Just Mercy. My dad read it and gave it to me, and it blew my mind. I really recommend everyone read the book Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, because you'll get perspective and history, and your heart will grow if you read that book.
Mm.
That's how intense it is. But one of the things the Equal Justice Initiative is doing recently is trying to sweep out from underneath the rug the history of lynching and racial terrorism that took place in this country, especially the late 1800s and throughout the 1900s. There are thousands of, you know, over 4,000 documented lynchings, and black families didn't migrate only because of job opportunities. There was also just pure terrorism. I digress. Brian Stevenson actually asked Andra to do a version of the song, and which is just a real honor. So she came to us, the band, and we're her songwriting team as well now. Like, we're writing toward the next album. But she came to us and said, "Well, I want to do Strange Fruit." And my initial thought was, "I'm not going to be a part of this." because I'm not going to play a groove. I know I'm not going to play a beat. I've not heard a bunch of versions of Strange Fruit, but I imagine a beat would not work.
Right.
I went and looked up and listened to a bunch of versions. Anything that had like a beat, like a recurring like ostinato pocket thing, doesn't work.
Right.
It's not right for the lyrics. There's no pattern that or groove per se that works. I came up with a recurring pattern that is pattern oriented, but it's not groove oriented, and it just involves mostly just varying drum rolls and textures. And the guys that I'm playing with, I trust them enough, and they trust me enough that I wasn't a timekeeper on that session.
Right.
Nando Rayo, the bass player, was the main timekeeper. He was kind of the only timekeeper. Everybody else is flowing outside of strict time.
And for Eddie and for any of the listeners, the Strange Fruit is actually the dead
bodies hanging from trees.
Bodies hanging from trees, which is like I didn't know that when somebody was like, "Oh yeah, you should listen to this song," and I was like so blown away by that message. So let's play that track. This is Andra Day doing a cover of Strange Fruit.
Thank you. father praying together for the wind to sail, for the sun to rise.
Talk a little bit about that drum part. That drum part, we were just kind of raving about it. Man, that was a heavy drum part, man.
Thanks, man. A lot of what happened on that session was pure magic at the time, but I had actually meditated on my part the night before we did the session. It was kind of heavy on my mind because of the subject matter and the history.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'd heard some versions of the song that had a beat-oriented thing, and
it wouldn't work.
It didn't do it justice.
No, you told. And you know what? The cool thing is, it was keeping time and it was making it hypnotic. It almost gave it like a cinematic feel. But I was picturing like an old revolutionary or an old Civil War kind of drummer.
That's the vibe I was trying to cultivate.
So heavy.
There was something I had in my mind that I don't expect any listener to gather. But maybe to feel viscerally, who knows? But this is something that motivated me, and I was picturing something that we're trying to do. My drum part, I was trying to speak through the drums what we're trying to do. The fading brat brat brat, that sort of represents the receding of the memory of people that got lynched.
Right.
The bring it. We're trying to bring it back. The rolls, the crescendo rolls. That's like we're trying to bring the memory of people that got lynched in the United States back.
Heavy,
and
man.
I'll tell you, man, the resistance to facing it is thick, and it's hard for me to understand. People will obfuscate in any way they can to the point that they'll talk about, hey, there were white people that got lynched. Well, okay, I'm sure there were white people that got hung from trees from time to time, but that's not
even
it's
close
not the
to
same
the
thing.
Yeah, not even close.
And there are a lot of people who don't want Robert E. Lee statues to be taken down, and a lot of them will say, and by the way, that's a local issue. If a locality wants to take that down, it's none of your business. But they'll say, oh, you're just trying to erase history, but they don't want those same people that say that they don't want to confront the history of racial terrorism.
Right.
I can't remember who I heard say this. I think it was Bryan Stevenson that I heard say that a lot of Black Americans were really offended by after 9/11 when people were saying on the news, "This is the first time we've ever faced terrorism in the United States," and they're just going,
"No.
Oh well, gosh, we moved." You know, from Kansas to Oklahoma because my granddaddy was lynched,
right?
And you know, or whatever. You know,
it's so, still you know, it's still a sensitive issue, and it's awesome.
Well, it's still
Andres,
affecting people
right.
today. Yeah,
but it's amazing that you're doing that, Shay. Real quick, we got to sign off in a little bit. Where can people find you on Twitter, on the interwebs? if they want to hire you for sessions.
Just go to my Instagram page. I literally don't have a website at the moment. It's pathetic.
That's all right.
But anyway, I'm not very good at marketing myself. But you can contact me through my Instagram. It's just Instagram.com/ShayGodwin, ShayGodwin. And, you know, anybody can feel free to email me at shaydrums@godwin.cc, shaydrums@godwin.cc. So that's GODWIN.cc.
Awesome.
Cool.
Shay, you've been a great guest.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for being a part of this. Incredible tunes.
Praise God.
And we'll see you back in sooner than you think.
Thank you, gents.